financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rahm.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rahm. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I am good. You are recovering from a little bit of a cold.
Yeah. Well, a sinus infection, unfortunately.
Your voice still sounds great, though. Yeah, not much, though. It's almost sounds perfect.
Thank you. What are you driving these days?
I mean, I'm going back and forth on whether I trade it in or not. I'm an older BMW. And it's a really cute little car, but it's time to go in, but I just don't want a car payment.
What year? BMW.
It's 2015.
It's not quite old enough for what I'm looking for this segment, but it's getting close.
What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about classic cars as an investment.
Okay.
And BMW happens to be one of the ones that's gaining in popularity, but we're talking about early 2000s for BMWs. But there are lots of other things to pay attention to. There was a great article where there was an interview from Hagerty. Hagerty is a classic car insurer, and they know a lot about classic cars. And the thing that I found most fascinating about it, well, there were lots of interesting things, but the thing I found most fascinating is that when you think of classic cars, mm-hmm. we think of baby boomers, right? Where's all the money? Baby boomers have all the money. They're buying those 50s, 60s muscle cars, right? Dodges and things. So the Charger, whatever. And it turns out that now it's millennials and Gen Zers that have the high interest in buying classic cars.
Oh, that's surprising.
It's a little surprising. It's sort of a matter of economics. If you think about mm-hmm. it, in 2008 financial crisis, right? After that, the job market, it was anybody's guess. I mean, people were worried about just affording their car, never mind whether they liked it or they wanted to buy a fun car, right? They were mm-hmm. just worried about affording it. But, 15 years after that, plenty of money is hanging around. And guess who's got it? The millennials and the Gen Zers. And there are a number of reasons that they might be interested in buying collectible cars as an investment. And this is quite far from the kinds of things that we normally talk about on this show, right? We talk about investments in annuities and investments in, other kinds of products that you might expect, CDs and other kinds of financial products and securities.
Yeah.
But in terms of hard investments, people often ask me about real estate. Is real estate a good investment? Blah, 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 right? But almost nobody asks me about cars, yet they buy cars. And I think the idea is that I will say a car is a bad investment. It loses money.
When you first brought this up, that's exactly what I thought you would think, because you always hear that as soon as you drive off a lot, it depreciates. Now, I know a classic car would be different, but you have to throw a lot of money into that, right?
Well, it depends on the car. And that's part of the appeal of these, dare I call them, newer classic cars. We're talking about late 80s, early 90s.
So sad that that's an older car, now a classic.
Well, I mean, even into the early 2000s, still classics. Now, people who know me know I love cars, right? One of my partners used to say that I romanticized cars. I gave them names and I like to drive them. And it's really true. I really like cars, but I don't see them as an investment typically.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's draw the line here. All right. The most expensive car sold in 2023 at auction was sold at the Sotheby's Paris auction for a little over what would equate to $10 million today.
Wow. What kind of car was that?
That was, let me see, a Bugatti. It was a one-of-a-kind Bugatti Profilet.
Oh, makes sense.
Chiron Profilet. So it sold for 9,792,500 euros.
Wouldn't you be scared to ever drive that?
Yeah.
I guess you don't buy it to drive it, but yeah.
Okay. So now there's a lesson. If you're just getting into this, or if you're thinking, hey, I might like to buy a car as an investment, and you're trying to rationalize that with your partner or just with yourself, right? Buy what you like. Buy something that's fun. Don't worry so much about it going up in value. I say this to people when they talk about, should they buy gold or silver, or should they buy Bitcoin, or what should, you know, everybody's concerned about what will I buy that I'm guaranteed it will go up in value. And thank you for playing. It doesn't work like that. Certainly not in the classic car market. There are some things that you can pretty much rest assured are probably going to go up in value, like that Chiron, right? But $10 million, you know, I mean,
yeah,
people getting into this don't have that kind of money. What they could be looking for is something that they have an interest in that is fun, that they would like to maybe drive, let's say, to car shows, right? That maybe they register, if it's old enough to be an antique, they can register it and pay 1/7 of the insurance and only drive it on Sundays or to car shows, right? So there's a way to keep your costs down a little bit about this. One of the things you could do to keep your costs down is do your research. Can you get parts for these things? How readily available are they? Can you get them at reasonable prices? Who's going to do the work on this car when it breaks, or in order to get it ready for a car show or for resale? So this might digress a little bit, but I've already confessed that I like cars. And in my garage right now is a 2005 Jaguar S-Type and a 2005 Mini Cooper S convertible.
Now, do you ever drive those?
I drive them all the time.
Oh, both okay.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the Mini Cooper S convertible, I actually purchased new, knowing that I would never drive it in the winter. It's never seen salt or a snowflake. It's in perfect condition, but I take it out when once they sweep the streets, when they sweep the streets, that's my clue for, okay, I can take the convertible out for a drive. Now, clearly, I have to be able to afford to do this. If this was a stretch for me, if I were talking to a client and this was a stretch, or they had other things they needed to spend their money on, I would say, don't do it, right? So the Jaguar I bought used, and I bought it just in March of this year. But I wanted a little background here. I had a rotator cuff problem, and driving the Cooper was, you know, it's a more tactile, you know, sports car kind of drive. You're really stuck to the road, but every little bump moves the wheel, and it's a standard. And I was just feeling it in my shoulder, and I thought, I've got to do something different, either park it, or maybe it's time for me to buy some sort of luxury sedan. So when I looked at luxury sedans, I looked at all kinds of things. Jaguar S-Type turned my head. Now, mechanics will tell you, you didn't make a smart purchase. It's not maybe the most reliable of the cars. You're going to spend money repairing it. They will leak oil. They will do these things. Okay, to me, that's almost part of the charm. The fact that the English would rather have beautiful burled wood on the dashboard than to get the electronics right, as I think there was a movie quote somewhere. Excuse me. That's part of its charm, believe it or not, to me. I don't expect to sell it for three times what I bought it for. I love driving the car. It's a beautiful car. It was a special order, radiance red, cream colored interior, had 73,000 miles on it. It's an 05. That's like 3,500 miles a year. Okay.
Yeah. It was somebody's baby. Yeah.
It was a one owner. The guy was 93 years old. And he was going into a facility and his friend was helping him sell the car. I had it looked at. I have a good mechanic. I'm fine with that. It's not my daily driver. I mean, if something is wrong with it, recently I parked it for 2 weeks while I drove my Toyota RAV4, which is my daily driver, right? So this is the kind of story that you'll hear from car collectors across the country or across the world. They have something they rely on every day to drive back and forth to work. They can't afford and don't want to put the miles on their classic cars. But, you know, even those two cars are a little new to quite be collectible classics, but I'm aging and so are they.
Yeah.
And they are in pristine condition.
It seems like there's two ways to look at this with classic car collectors. One's an emotional decision and one's more financial. So the emotional one would be you've got two cars that you love driving and you take them out at specific times, but you're not expecting a big return. If you are expecting a big return, what should you do? Should you be looking for a car you're never going to drive and you're just going to park it?
Well, first of all, I think you'd be hard pressed to separate the emotion from the financial part when it comes to a classic car.
Okay.
Even people with deep pockets buy stuff that they have a fondness of. You know, oh, I remember when my father used to drive us here in this car, and I want one of those, and I can afford to buy it, and I'm going to buy the best one I can buy.
Right.
Maybe they drive it, maybe they don't. There was a local person, I won't mention him by name, but people will know who he was. Avid car collector. I mean, huge garage with really spectacular automobiles. Somebody was paid to just take care of the automobiles. That was their
Nice.
job, right? But when he wanted to drive one, he could drive it. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, what would I recommend? I would recommend what I said, buy something that you like. Hope that it goes up in value. Do your research. You know, I'll give you some examples of things that Haggerty's thought on Haggerty. Haggerty puts out a bull market list every year.
Okay.
Their 2025 list isn't out yet, but it'll probably be out soon, I think. But the 2024 list highlighted some things like 1980s Lamborghini Countaches. Okay,
Okay.
that might cost you some money to buy, but also 2000 era BMW M3s.
Oh.
All right. Oh, she says,
Oh, well, maybe I'll
oh.
hang on to this. Rewind for 1 second. For those of us who don't know, what is a bull market list?
Oh, it's a list of things that you think are a good buying opportunity.
Okay.
All right. A bear market list would say hold back, don't necessarily buy, maybe sell. Okay.
Okay.
But bull market list is I'm buying it with the hope that it's going up in value.
Okay.
Maybe even the expectation that it has a good chance of going up in value. A surprise on that list might have been the Plymouth Prowler. Who
Oh, I don't
thinks
even
of
remember that car. Yeah, I don't remember
well,
that.
it was a late 90s car. And the key here is they may go up in value. Haggerty isn't saying, look, if you look at our list, buy something here and it's going to be worth three times its value tomorrow. It's here's what we think might increase in value. They also recommend, you know, what's his name? McKeel. Haggerty recommends don't buy cars only as an investment. And I would say the same thing. You know,
Yeah.
those two cars I talked about, I don't think they're the best investment in the world. I didn't buy them because I thought they would be an investment. I bought them because they spoke to me. You know, each car is very different from the other. Here's another little background, and I'm sorry to give you so much background on this, folks, but you know, I just want you to understand when I'm talking about this topic, it's not that I'm an expert in the field. I'm just like you. If you're a car enthusiast, I'm just like you. My very first car that I remember actually putting together myself, you know, and registering and saying, this is my car, not something my
Yeah.
parents gave me to drive, was a 1960 Sunbeam Alpine. Now,
Oh, I
it
love
was
that.
old. If you think, how old is she? It was old when I built it, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't the Tiger. I couldn't really afford to build a Tiger. A Tiger was. Think Maxwell Smart. If you ever saw a Maxwell Smart movie where he drove up in that little tiny British sports car with little fins on the
Yep.
back, okay, that looks like an Alpine, but they chopped off the fins and they stuffed a 289 engine in it and
Oh.
it screamed down the road and they called it the Tiger. I could not afford, nor would my parents probably have
Let
approved of me
you.
building a
Yeah.
Tiger. But a 1960 Alpine I could build. And I got all the jokes you can imagine when I would go for parts. That's a Sunbeam. Wait, isn't that my razor I shaved with this morning? That's a car. You know, I would get it all. Again, it was part of the charm. But I built it from three parts cars with two good mechanics who were close friends who helped me for almost no money. And I mean, I was right in there, hands on, greased up to my elbows, loving every minute of it. And that's probably where I got my real start in, you know, I love cars. I love cars with round headlights. Now, you talk about an emotional or silly reason to buy a car. I really like the look of round headlights. I like round, smooth lines. I recently, when I was car shopping, thought about a Tesla, and I loved the outside look of the Tesla, but I didn't like the inside look. It didn't seem old enough for me. I'm a throwback when it comes to cars, you know.
Yeah, it's very techy on the inside of the Teslas.
It is, and that's part of their charm, but it wasn't for me. And so if you're looking at classic cars, we're going to talk to you a lot more, of course, about this, but thanks for letting me share my stories.
Well, let's get your phone number if people have questions, maybe about investing in cars.
Oh boy, can't wait for this one.
Yeah,
413-773-3333.
You can also go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be right back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. We're talking about classic cars as investments.
We are. It so makes me want to go out for a drive, though. You know, beautiful weather, clear roads. Mm-hmm. We have a beautiful area to drive in around here and see the sights. And it's just to go back to the three vehicles sitting in my garage. If you think the Money Doctor has three vehicles, how good can she be with money? I'm just going to tell you, when I talk to people about money, it isn't about hoarding every penny. Money to me is a means to an end. Now, that doesn't mean you should blow it all and try and end up broke by the time you're 65, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a balance. There's a certain amount of money that you earn that can go for things that maybe someone else thinks is frivolous, but which pleases you, which makes you happy. That might be taking care of your grandchildren. It might be buying real estate. It might be traveling. It might be classic cars. But it's your money to do with what you want to. I'm just trying to help you help give some guidance as to if this speaks to you, if what you want to do is buy a classic car and you can afford it, not just afford mm-hmm. to buy it, afford to repair it, afford to insure it, afford to let it sit undriven for who knows how much time. Basically, when people are buying classic cars and we're not sure they're going to go up in value, which is most people who buy classic cars, or go up in value enough, I would say give you caution in two areas. One is it only matters if it goes up in value if you plan to sell it. This is the same argument that we have about real estate when people say to me, part of my assets for retirement is my house. I have a lot of equity mm-hmm. in my house. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to sell your house? And if so, are you going to have to spend that equity to buy the next house? Or are you right. going to live in it? Or are you going to take a reverse mortgage or something like that? Well, it's the same with cars. I don't want to hear about why you bought it because it's going up to three times its value unless you're going to extract that value in some way. Otherwise, I'm just happy you could afford it. You got a car you loved. Maybe you'll trade it for another car you love someday. But one of the things that appeals to people about this kind of an investment, as opposed to monetary investments that are non-tangible, mm-hmm. is that these people meet. There's a society of car enthusiasts, and they race cars sometimes. They go to car shows, right? They have events. There was just a fundraiser event that my sister went to. Ironically, there's a funny coincidence here. Who has a car show once a year to raise money for a rescue league for pets. And they raised $14,000 yeah. for it in
well,
one
you
day.
See it all the, you see it all the time, especially in all the small towns. There's always car shows like every Saturday. I see them all the time. And then you see the long line of the classic cars driving by you. And I yeah. love that. I don't mind slowing down for that because it's so yeah. cool to see like the old Model Ts and like you said, some of the revved up sports cars. But I like the old like the Model Ts and stuff.
Yeah, one of the things I like about this, Jess, is the individuality of it. You know, you don't go to one of these car shows. I think Tom's Hot Dogs has a long history in Hatfield of having a car show as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to that, you don't see, you know, here's all the Plymouths lined up. Here's all the Fords lined up. You will see a vast variety of cars. And you'll see people who dress like their cars or who wear costumes from the period. I mean, people get into this.
Yeah, it's a whole community.
Yeah, it's a community. Another thing people like to do is they go to what we call swap meets or parts fairs where you can walk around and find that wheel for your 1942 Hudson or yeah. whatever it was, you know. And so there's a certain involvement in this, a personal touch to it that makes people, that draws people in and makes them perhaps more interested in this as an investment as something else. I just want to caution you, no investment should take all of your money. This mm-hmm. is an opportunity to diversify into something that you like to drive or care to own for some reason, and it may increase your portfolio in value. There's some interesting stats that I like to, we always like to tell you about stats so that, you know, I'm not just pulling this out of my hat. You know, hey, I like cars. Let's talk about cars today, right? Although, oh boy, Click and Clack. Oh my gosh, I used to love that show. They cracked me up. But anyway, Yahoo Finance did a survey and they found that 75% of Gen Zers said that they loved or liked to drive. Now, this flies in the face of the fact that people say, oh, Gen Zers, they don't even want to get their licenses. They take an Uber everywhere. Well, it isn't quite true. Now, that may also have something to do with economics, right? They're making more money, all of that. But it's really the baby boomers who drove that collector market, that large collector market, up to a new level. But Gen Zers and millennials now are the ones out there fishing for cars. In fact, they did a survey on 40% of the people responded. And of those 47% of the people, Gen Zers, 60% of them said they had an interest in buying a classic car. Now, those are people born between 97 and 2012, right? Baby boomers, only 31% of them said they had an interest in buying a classic car.
Do we think
Interesting.
that Gen Zers have an interest in it because they all moved home with mommy and daddy and now they can afford it? Is
Well,
that
let
it?
me
Could
tell
that be
you.
it?
Okay, here's my tough love money doctor moment. If you're living on mommy and daddy's couch and you buy a classic car and they let you do it, my brain rattles around in my head. This is for excess money. This is for money that you can afford to not recoup if you, at least at the lower levels, at the levels we're talking about, 80s, 90s, 2000, you know. What do we say, BMW M3s and things? If you can afford to buy this and maybe be wrong, maybe it doesn't increase in value, then I think that's an okay buy for you and you want to do it, that's fine. I'm the perfect example of I probably would get my money out. Oh, here's another tip. Buy it right if you can get a great deal. Now, I shudder to tell you what I paid for that Jaguar. And it certainly wasn't because I was taking advantage of somebody. It was because the opportunity just popped right into my hands. I mean, yeah, I was looking around going, yeah, maybe some luxury sedan. How about this? How about that? No, I don't want to pay that much money. You know, I looked at Maserati. Now, you would think
Oh,
Maserati,
wow.
here's a perfect example. You would think Maserati would cost you a fortune, be way out of the reach of most people. There were used Maseratis in the same age range as the Jag, you know, 12, 13,000, sometimes $9,500. It's got the Maserati name on it, but my research led me to believe, oh no, you don't want that one because if it just needs brakes, it's $3,500, right? Or whatever. So you have to not just look at the name and the car, but what the cost of upkeep is, because if you let it run down, as I said, these two are in pristine condition and I keep them that way, right? If you let it run down, then you have a problem. Now, that being said, I want to talk to you about car repair for just a moment. Again, from personal experience. I had a problem with the air conditioning in the Jag. Now, I could pay $1,500 to $1,800 to repair the air conditioning if I took it to one mechanic and they just said, this is what's wrong, or I could take a different route. Now, you
What'd
have
you
to be
do?
able, well, for right now, the air conditioning isn't working, to tell you the truth, because I don't need the air conditioning working at the moment, but I have found a route to repair it for much less money. But you have to be willing to do those kinds of things and think about it as a monetary expense or investment. So, for instance, my initial comment was, wait a minute, I only paid this much for the car, you know. If I put that much into it, I will have overpaid for this car. I will have put more money into it than it's worth on the market. And because it's not a safety issue, and it's not a mechanical issue, and I don't have this car as a straight investment, I just say, you know what? For this year, I'm going to roll down the windows or drive the convertible. What do I care if this doesn't have air conditioning at the moment? It's a harder decision. You want to put it in perfect condition. You want it to always, you know, you want to always, keep it in pristine condition. But I watch out for these emotional rationalizations, like this is my baby, so I'm going to do it. Now, when it needed brakes, you betcha, I'm going to do it. If it needs something that, like oil, there's an oil leak, I'm going to do it because that has to do with the health of the car.
And
And
maintaining the value of it.
that's right, maintaining the value and its longevity and my ability to drive it happily and safely. Those things are going to take precedence. But But the other things that are sort of fluff, you know, if you want to put blue LED lights under your car, you need to think about how much you're increasing your cost basis while we're in investment world here. Let me use an investment term. How much your in cost basis has increased, and are you able to get your money out of that if you sell it? If not, then what you're paying for is a hobby. And that's okay. It, again, if you can afford it, if you and your partner are in agreement and it's not causing a major, you know, row in your world, okay, then you call it a hobby and you throw money at it. But for a serious car enthusiast, a serious investor, you will keep track of your expenses and your cost basis on that vehicle and know what you can get out of it if you have to sell it today, tomorrow, the next day.
Well, two really important things that I think you said are research and having a good mechanic. You know, research that you're not overpaying it to begin with, but then also finding a mechanic that you trust that will lead you in the right direction where you might be able to do this repair and not do this other major one and still maintain the value. But finding a good mechanic is like number one.
Well, it is number one, but I will say that sometimes you start out trusting a mechanic. They build a relationship with you. Maybe something changes in the back, or you know, or something changes for them, and now they start to, now they know they've got your trust, and they're starting to say, "Well, I think you should do this, that, and the next thing." Again, we go back to research. For just about any classic car, there are forums everywhere. You get on the internet, you find a forum. I learned a lot about the Jag before I bought it. In forums where people said, you know, you read the same messages over and over again. Hey, you know, air conditioning might be a problem, or this might be a problem, or that might be a problem. You're not going to find, most often, you're not going to find a car that is perfect for everything. I looked at a Lexus. Lexus was one of the cars I considered, and they were pricier. And I thought at first, well, maybe they're pricier because they need less repairs, but I found the repairs to be just as costly. And I didn't, and the particular kind of Lexus I was looking at, I didn't find one I loved. And so I just moved on to another brand. I kicked a lot of tires, right? But when that Jag opportunity, you know, I wasn't in a rush to do it. And that's what I'm saying to car enthusiasts too. Look, if this is something you want, it's not your daily driver. You don't have to do it today. Spend the time, enjoy the research. You know, I test drove a number of different models and kinds of cars. I talked to people, I talked to mechanics about them. I called two or three mechanics and said, if I'm looking for a luxury sedan, maybe in this price range, what would you recommend? And they gave me opinions. And that's how I know. Some people said, well, I don't, the Jaguar S type, I don't know, but it'll be okay if it doesn't have these things, you know, and they give you some parameters. And I think that's always worth looking at. So just like anything else, do your research, ask people, don't trust blindly. You know, if you're looking at a car, ask if it's okay to bring it to your mechanic and have it gone over before you pay for the car, and make sure that you're getting something that is sound and that you're going to appreciate, and you're not buying a lemon or a
And I can
money.
imagine, I can imagine if they balk at that, then there's probably a red flag. They don't want you to bring it to your mechanic.
Yeah, I think there should be some way for you to at least get your mechanic to look at the records that are there. I wouldn't just trust a Carfax on these things. They're older cars. You know, these cars were around before Carfax was. So,
Yeah,
you
true.
know,
All right,
get
well,
somebody knowledgeable to help you.
what is your phone number if somebody wants to give you a call to ask some questions about this or anything else
Sure.
financial?
They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
And as always, you can go to hugyourmoney.com. This was fun today.
Thanks. I had fun too.
All right, we'll be back again next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ryan, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com. Would you like to see your business on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor? We offer a 15-year proven track record. We have limited openings, but are currently seeking sponsors and guests. Is your business a good fit? We'd like to start a conversation. Contact us today at 413-773-3333 or info@hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Rayum. Hello.
Well, hello, Jess. How's it going?
It's good. We are back for another week of money talk.
What are we talking about this week? We are. Well, let's talk about mortgages this week, but not mortgage rates, but how many people are holding their mortgage or even using it as an investment tool into their retirement years past age 65?
Okay.
Yeah, I bristle just having to say that you have a mortgage past age 65, but so many people do.
It's longer before you can afford your first house with how much they are right now. And then you talk 30, 40 year mortgage. If you refinance, you very well could have a mortgage that old. Not that old at that age, I should say.
Yeah, well, the mortgage would be that old too. Yeah. Can you even believe that we are saying 40 year mortgages these days?
Mm. Yeah, you have to be able to afford the house.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the sad truth is that, and they've been doing this in California for a while now, when house prices just were unaffordable. People can't make the payment. You can't sell the houses. You can't lend to them. What do? Stretch out the term. Mm. So that's kind of a similar thing as to what's going on for retirees these days, except that they're doing it in some cases proactively. And I'll give credit here to the New York Times, who had a great article on this. And they really saw both sides of the coin here, what some advisors say you should do and what others say you should do, right? They're completely different. So it might not be any surprise to you that I'm in the camp of, no, don't keep your debt into retirement.
Really? I thought it was going to be the other way for sure.
Well, you know, of course, the reason I say that is because, you know, if you have to pay $1,000, $2,000 a month in a mortgage in retirement, that's all money that's being depleted from your retirement nest egg.
Do you think that people go into a 40-year mortgage, though, thinking that they're going to be able to pay double to get it paid off quicker? They're just like, I'll take it for now, but I'll pay more because they think they're going to be making more?
Maybe. I mean, there are two sides to that coin also. A lot of times people will push themselves into a 15-year mortgage saying that they don't want to have it at retirement they don't want to have it for longer than 15 years. And so they take that higher payment to get rid of the debt in 15 years. And there's nothing wrong with that if you can afford it easily. But because of our program, because of the way that we see people pay off all their debt, including their mortgage, right, in less than 10 years, usually around 8 years for our average client, because we see it that way, because I see it that way differently now than I used to, I would say to most clients, look, if the interest rates are similar, they don't have to be the same, but if they're similar, you might want to take the 30-year mortgage and keep that payment low so that you don't box yourself into a higher payment in case something happens in the future. I don't know about you, but my crystal ball doesn't stretch out 30 years. You know, a lot of stuff's going to happen.
Tricky question for you. So if you have enough money to be able to take out a 15-year mortgage to be able to make that payment comfortably, would you be better off taking off a 30-year and then just paying it off quicker because it's going to make your credit better? And would that be a better way to go?
I'm going to say only if you're doing something like our program, right?
Okay.
Patented. So I don't know if there's something like our program out there, but if you're doing something like this, where we are managing all of the debt together and accelerating those payoff schedules drastically, then I do recommend that very often because people can take that lower payment, put it in the system, and as we start to pay off their other debts and focus on cash reserves and retirement, that money from those other creditors that you don't owe any longer can start going to your mortgage. So you're not sending any more out monthly. You're used to that monthly outlay already. But at some point, your mortgage becomes a priority debt and gets paid off ahead of schedule. So you still have a similar effect if you follow the plan, but that's true of anything. If you follow the plan of paying your 15-year mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. But when people do it artificially, what they tend to think of is, okay, I'm going to make double payments or I'm going to make an extra payment. I'm going to pay it biweekly because that's one extra payment a year. Mm-hmm. Those things are effective. There's no arguing that it's effective to pay off your debt early. It's just, what is the smartest way to do it? How can you do it with the least amount of pain and the quickest way possible? And that's what I'm looking for people, because yes, you take out your mortgage now, but you know what? There's going to be expenses. There's going to be job losses, health problems, children growing up, going to college, marriages, unexpected car expenses, your washing machine is going to break. Everything is going to happen in the future.
Well, and as a new homeowner, you know, there's going to be home expenses.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And taxes are going to continue to do what? Well, they aren't going
up.
They aren't going down, folks. So taxes will go up. Cost of living will go up. Your insurances, all of that, they're all going to be on the rise. And as your house continues to rise in value, as we hope it does, we don't plan for it, but we hope it does, guess what's going up with it? Your taxes and your insurance rates. So for a retiree who hasn't thought of that, let's say you're age 65, you're retiring and you're thinking, boy, I've got a great way to get the money out of my house. I'm going to refinance my house, pull a bunch of cash out. I'll just make the mortgage payment. I won't ever plan to pay that mortgage off. I'll just tolerate it through my retirement years. Guess what happens? It looks good on paper now, but next year, your taxes go up. The year after that, your insurance goes up. Your cost of living rises. So that math that you did, that quick and dirty math that you did that said, wow, this is a great idea. It looks good now, but what does it look like 10 years forward, 5 years forward, 15 years forward? And what does it look like if you plan to leave your home to your children and now it's mortgaged to the hilt? That's just the beginning of the rub. Now, there are lots of financial advisors out there, I believe, that are saying, do this. And the reason they're saying, do this, I'm not blaming them. I hate to say it, but they don't know what we know yet, right? I didn't know what we know yet 15 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So without knowing how to accelerate your debt payoff and balance that cash reserve and retirement picture, without really doing a comprehensive picture, what most financial advisors are trained to do, myself included prior to inventing this system, is to look at how much are you paying on your debt? How much are you earning in the market? Oh, well, gee, you're paying 3% on your wonderful mortgage that you got a year or two ago, and you're making 6% in the market. It doesn't make any sense to take your assets out and pay off your mortgage. So we're just going to tell you to keep your mortgage and make the payment because we're always going to earn more than 3% in the market. Well, while that might be true, it might not be true. And in order to count on that, you have to take very conservative investments in order to rely on the fact that the market will out-earn your mortgage. You have to remember that these markets are moving all the time.
Right.
And that would mean that you take very conservative investments. In other words, maybe a CD or a treasury bill. Well, that might not align with your 30-year mortgage, right? You might get that for 5 years, but not 30. What happens at the end of 5 years if those rates go down and now they're paying 2% or 1% like they were not all that long ago and your mortgage is at 3? That mortgage doesn't look so appealing any longer.
So are you saying that it's always better to pay off the mortgage first rather than let that money stay in the market? Or it depends on the situation?
How long have you known me, Jess? Yes, I am never always saying anything. I'm certainly not wishy-washy about this. If you can afford to pay your mortgage off, I believe it's a better thing for people to go into retirement debt-free. You can call it emotional comfort if you want to, but I've just seen way too many people who are carrying debt into their retirement years, thought it was going to be just great, and something happened. Even as simple as we had to help our kids out. Our kids were faced with, you know, they're going to live in the street if we didn't pay their rent.
Well, you don't
plan that into retirement, but you can't do it if you're saddled with that mortgage.
All right. So, but about refinancing, should that always be a last resort for refinancing?
Oh, no, I don't think it's a last resort. I think there are times that refinancing makes sense, just maybe not as a strategy to get through retirement all the time. Okay. So here's a good example. Somebody's got one of the mortgages they get today at 8.25% or whatever the rates are now, whatever the ugly rates are today. And, you know, they take it because they've got a downsize, for instance, and they decide they're going to keep, we're talking about retirees now. So they decide they're going to keep their money in their brokerage account or their assets liquid enough in case they need it, rather than put it on the down payment of a house. So they downsize, they get a new mortgage. They decide, maybe with the help of an advisor, maybe not, it's a good idea to just do it this way and only pay the mortgage payment without any idea of ever paying the mortgage off. And 2 years from now, the rates are at 3%. Do you refinance? Probably. You
Yeah.
probably do. You get the better rate. But what you need to remember when you're refinancing, I always try to tell people the one or two things that nobody else is telling them that they just somehow escapes mainstream knowledge. And the thing that you have to remember mostly is if you ever plan to pay that mortgage off, and I realize some people just accept it. They just say, I'm just going to pay this like rent the rest of my life. But if you ever plan to pay that mortgage off, you need to remember that when you refinance, these loans are front heavy. In other words, the interest is up front. So now, if you've been paying your mortgage for 5 or 10 years and you're finally starting to chip away at the principal, you know, when you get that statement, you look at it and it says X number of dollars to the interest and X number of dollars to the principal. If you're finally starting to make some headway and you refinance, thank you for playing. You're going back to the
Back to the
beginning again.
beginning. Oh, yeah.
Most of your payment is going to be interest again because that's how the loans are created. That's what the amortization schedules look like. So there's so many things to think of when you're thinking of this, and there are reasons that you might consider doing this. But what I'm trying to make a point of is I don't think it should be your number one or even at, toward the top of your list retirement strategy. I'm just going to refinance my house, take the cash out, and that's how I'm going to do retirement. If there's any other way for you to do it, and there usually is, there's probably a better plan than just taking your mortgage out and carrying it through retirement because you think or are told or you hope that the market is always going to outearn your mortgage rate because there's so many other factors besides what your investments are earning.
And it's been all over the place, so we haven't really been able to tell if it's going to be up, down. It seems like it's been down. All
Yeah,
right, well,
just this week.
we're going to talk more about this coming up in the second half, but first I want to get your phone number.
Sure, it's 413-773-3333.
And as always, you can visit hugyourmoney.com. We haven't mentioned in a while, but I want to mention that if you have a question for the money doctor, you can send your question in at info@hugyourmoney.com, or you can send it to me at jtyler@whmp.com. Then if we use your question on the air, you can get a copy of the book.
Retire debt and retire well. You bet. That's my favorite part is when people write in with questions and we
I
get to
love it too.
answer them on the air.
All right, we'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP. Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and we're talking mortgages.
We are talking mortgages. We're talking mortgages into your retirement years and what that can do for you or not do for you. And so I just want to make the point that we're not talking about reverse mortgages here. A reverse mortgage is where you give up the equity in your home, you sign a contract to a company who then pays you instead of you paying the mortgage, right? They pay you every month, and you are basically spending down the equity in your home.
That's those late night commercials we see, right? We're back on commercials again this week, but the late night commercials you see, I always think they're ripping off the elderly. Is that true or not?
Well, it might be true in some cases, and in some cases, it's a good idea for people. It depends. So, again, the things you need to know about that is, you know, tell your kids if they're expecting to inherit your house and you've got a reverse mortgage, they need to be aware that they're going to get in the same week some news that their parents died and that they owe a mortgage in order to access that house again, because that mortgage then has to get paid off. So you're basically racking up debt, but you're doing it with a reverse mortgage. And
You're basically
force
leaving it to your kids.
the mortgage, not the house. Yes.
And so, but are the kids responsible for the mortgage even though they're not on it if
Well,
they inherit the house?
not directly, but somebody has to be responsible for that mortgage. So if the kids want to keep the house, then they have to pay off that mortgage. If they don't care and they sell the house, then the mortgage has to be repaid, right? That's how that company that lent the money got repaid. So those are tricky, but it's not what we're talking about today. But I just wanted to make it clear that when I'm saying don't use a mortgage as your retirement strategy or as your primary retirement strategy, I'm not necessarily talking about reverse mortgages. I'll give you one example of a time when a reverse mortgage might make good sense for someone. Let's say that they don't have any kids, or that their children don't want the house, or they don't need the house, and the parents are living on minimal income, and they don't intend to downsize or do anything else. Or even in downsizing, sometimes people use a reverse mortgage as a way to downsize. But then that might be a way for them to gain the equity out of their house, as long as nobody's expecting to get it in the end. Then they get rid of their mortgage because the company takes it over, and the company pays them a monthly payment as a reverse mortgage. Sometimes that can make very good sense for somebody, but I fear that too many people do it when they don't understand it well. And so when you said, are they ripping people off? Maybe not intentionally, but I think there are plenty of reverse mortgages that are sold to people who maybe had a better or a different solution.
And well, it seems like always when you're in a situation where you're desperate for money, good choices are not made. Like you're just kind of thinking of the only thing that's going to get you money quick.
Yeah. Well, that's true of any kind of choice, not just financial choices. Whenever we're making decisions emotionally and from our gut and under pressure, under duress, we're
going to make bad decisions. Are you talking about being hangry?
Well, as a matter of fact, that's one of them. That's a great analogy because, you know, what we eat and how we spend money are very, very much parallel, right? I say that about myself. I have this really strong survival instinct in my belly. And so when I get hungry, I really do. When I get hungry, I want food. I have to
steer
be
clear.
Careful. Yeah, I have to be careful to make sure that I have things on hand that I can eat. Okay, I'm hungry, but I'm having an apple. Or I'm hungry, but I'm having a salad. And if I don't plan that out in advance, I can tell you honestly, I mean, I'm just, you know, here I am, folks, real human. I'm going to tell you honestly, if I'm hungry and the thing in the kitchen is a chocolate bar, I'm eating it. Right?
Exactly.
So I have to plan in advance. How am I going to manage that? And the same thing is true about your retirement, right? You have to plan this in advance. The thing is, it should not all be on your shoulders. One of the things that is hardest to do is to make plans when it's your money, right? That's where a coach or a financial advisor should come into play and be able to help you. But they have to know this stuff. And I don't think we're teaching it to financial advisors. What we're teaching is if you're making this much money in the market, which by the way, I'm probably making money on, and you're paying that much mortgage, gee, it looks pretty close to me, but I'm going to say, let's keep the money in the market because that's your earning power. And to a large extent, they're right. Yes, I want to keep the money in the market and have your earning power, but I don't want to do it at the cost of risking your home, which is what we're talking about. Now, let's suppose you do this. Let's suppose that you think a good retirement strategy is to take out the mortgage on your home, take the cash out, whether you're calling it a home equity line or a first mortgage, it's still secured by your home and it's still a mortgage. Just because it has a different name doesn't mean it's not a mortgage, right? People argue that point a lot with me. No, no, it's a home equity line. It's a
same
mortgage.
Thing.
Yeah, well, we used to call them second mortgages and that creeped people out. So now we call them HELOCs or home equity
lines. We just put a prettier name on it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if that's your plan is to take that money out and you do that, let's suppose it looks good for a couple of years. And then a time rolls around where you had planned to work through retirement. Gee, you love your job. You're not going to sit in a rocking chair. You really are going to keep working. Well, you know what? You might not be in control of that. Somebody might say we're downsizing and you don't have a job any longer. Or you might run your own business and find out you just can't get the employees to do the work to keep the doors open. You thought you would sell your business and it's not saleable, or you thought you would pass your business to your kids who have no interest in it. There's so many things that you think will happen in retirement. But just as you pointed out, Jess, the hardest time to decide that is when you're in the thick of it, when you can't see the forest for the trees. When you're looking at that retirement date, counting the days, saying, oh, if I check this box, if I move that there, and if I do this, maybe if I refinance my house, I can hit that target date. Oh, I cannot wait to take that vacation and tell my friends I've retired, right?
Yeah.
And that looks good for a while. And then these kinds of things happen, like your kids come home from college and say, Mom, Dad, you know, I need a place to stay. I can't afford rent, or I'm getting a divorce, or somebody's spouse dies, or there's some major event that none of us want to plan for. Somebody gets really ill. You know, there's some reason that you can't live where you are. Maybe you're a renter. You're not a person who pays a mortgage and your rent has just gotten astronomically high and you can't qualify for rental assistance or anything and you have to move somewhere else. That's going to be a major financial change for you. And speaking of that, some of the people that get hit hardest with this idea about refinancing their mortgage or carrying their mortgage into retirement are people with lower income. Sadly, very often people of color, not always, but the statistics show us that that area of people tends to get hit harder with this because, in some way, oddly enough, talk about the things you don't think of, right? They very often don't have the extra money hanging around to keep up their property. So they might not redo their kitchen and redo their bathroom or, make their yard look perfect or whatever because they're busy just trying to eke out a living. And then the times change, they go to refinance that property or borrow against it, and they have a harder time doing it because the property value isn't rising at the same level as maybe somebody who had plenty of cash who's done all these things to keep their property up. And they have higher expenses to do it, right? They're a dollar for somebody who barely ekes out a living is a lot harder to come up with than for somebody who has plenty of money. So if you have to redo your roof and you have plenty of money, $30,000 is not, you grouse about it for a moment, but you sign the line, dotted line, or you give them the money and you get your roof redone. If you're somebody who can't afford that, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, you're going to lose
So,
money in the end.
yeah, and turning around and saying, well, I'm going to refinance my house again can be problematic because now it has to pass an appraisal. The bankers have to be happy with it. Maybe it's not in the condition to do that. And trying to argue the case that, well, I want the refinance because I'm going to repair my roof and do this is sometimes hard if your income can't float it. So you can see I'm going in a big circle here, right? But the circle I'm going in is because, boy, I just think it's so sad to put your house at risk in order to retire when there could be a much better way to do it. And if you can imagine that, your dreams are dashed because something happens in the future. Like, I hate to bring this up, but what happens if Social Security has a problem, right? We all think Social Security is going to last because it's political suicide for it not to, but they're doing it already, delaying the years you can retire. They're pretty soon they're going to start delaying how much money you can get out of it. They've already done it for teachers, right? If you paid into the retirement system for Social Security, but you've taught most of your life, guess what? Thank you very much for the money. Right? We're applying that windfall thing to you. So, we cannot expect that stuff to just continue to last on and on and on. And so I think it's really important for people to get all of the details about this and not just see it as what it looks like today in today's dollars.
I have a question for you. This is a little off topic, but just a financial advisor question, and it could pertain to this, but how much more difficult is it for you when a couple comes in to make these decisions versus a single person? Like, I can't imagine every husband and wife, especially ones that have been together 30, 40 years, or maybe they do, are in agreement on what to do about retirement. Or when it's joint money decisions, it seems like as a financial advisor, you're part marriage counselor, it seems.
Well, I'm not a licensed marriage counselor, but I sure hear a lot of problems. That's a very interesting question. It is a different process for people. The couples, most often, by the time I talk to them, have formed some kind of an agreement. They may not be completely on the same page, and sometimes they're very opposite, especially when there's a big age difference, as is more and more common these days. Where one person's ready to retire and the other person is saying, but I'm going to keep working. And one person is saying, but I want to travel. And the other person is saying, but I can't, And so there's a lot of finding of middle ground when that happens. And interestingly enough, for single people, you would think that they're just like, hey, I don't have anybody else to worry about, so here's my retirement plan. But interestingly enough, it seems to me that they worry even more. They don't feel like they have the safety net of a second income.
Oh,
They
that's true. Yeah.
very often have children that they want to go and visit or take care of, and it's going to be harder on one income. They sometimes will tell me that part of their retirement plan is that they're going to meet somebody. More often than not, they'll add a fictitious person in the future as part of their retirement plan. This person is always going to be affluent and take care of them and nobody says, I'm going to meet somebody. They're going to be a deadbeat and they're going to live on my couch and I'm going to have to take care of them too,
The
I
kid's
already
going to
have
be an
four
NFL
children.
star.
Yeah, it is a different decision. But I think to answer your question, more and more these days, I see as couples, I see the people as more and more independent of one another. They're in a unit, they're a team, and they're making decisions together. But 15 years ago, couples would come in or call me and they would be like, my husband's going to retire and I need to understand how this works because I'm the one who takes care of the money. And that would be it. Sometimes they'd say, well, I have a job too, but I'm not really contributing to anything. And even today, we've talked about this, women are not contributing anywhere as much as their male counterparts are. They
Into the
tend to
living expenses every month or into
no, into
retirement
their
or
retirement.
okay, got it.
They tend to see the money in the household as his retirement, with theirs being ancillary. And that's hard when a couple splits, right? Or one dies or something happens. So, but what I see is that they talk to me in a more independent way within the marriage unit about, well, she's going to retire then, or I'm going to retire now, or he's going to retire in 5 years, but I'm not going to. And instead of, when my husband retires, this is what life will look like. Now they're both trying to figure it out within the marital context. And so you always ask the most interesting questions. The ones I love come from real people, like you, who aren't financial geeks, who just say, but this is what happens in my life. Does that happen to other people?
Exactly. Well, so much good information here. I know that people probably will have questions, so how can they get a hold of you?
Well, I hope so. They can reach us at 413-773-3333 or on the web at hugyourmoney.com.
And as we talked about before, I really would love if people send questions in. I do have some questions saved for you, so we're going to do a question show coming up really soon. And then, like we said, if you get one of your questions that get on the air, we answer them, you answer them, and I go, "Oh, I knew that." Then you're going to get a copy of the book, and the book is kind of this is a reissue, correct?
It is actually. Let's see.
Oh, you have a copy right
I have a
there,
copy right
Haley.
here. Look, Retire Debt and Retire Well. And we reissued it because we kept the same stories that everybody loved, but we added retirement information in and budget information and more things about what are relevant today. And so retire sooner, live better, debt free, including your mortgage, which after all was a point today. So
Exactly. And
yes.
I've got to say, it's such an easy read too. And I love that you kind of dispersed real stories in with the advice because it just made it fun to read.
Well, thank you. Thanks. That was the idea, is that, we call this financial fitness, not, here's how to trade the market, because it's about real people and their real money and being financially fit in your lifestyle.
So if you have a question and you want a chance to win a copy of the book, you can send those questions into info@hugyourmoney.com. You can also send them to me here at JTYLER@WHMP.com. And you can go to hugyourmoney.com and get a hold of Dr. Francis Ram. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Thank you, Jess.
All right. We'll be back next week again with another episode of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.